Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. In this segment of Books by Us, we are speaking with Daisy Hernandez, author of A Cup of Water Under My Bed, and co-editor of Colonize This, Young Women of Color on Today's Feminism. Daisy is the co-editor of this book and the former editor of Color Lines magazine. She speaks at colleges and conferences about feminism, race, and media representations, and her writing has appeared in New York Times, Ms. Magazine, Culture Strike, In These Times, Bellingham Review, Fourth Genre, and Hunger Mountain on the NPR's All Things Considered. Oh, wow. Welcome, Daisy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Oh, we're really excited. This is just a beautifully written book.
Thank
you. We read the Advocate. Yeah, we read the Advocate article on it. My mom flipped when I tried to ask for dating advice, and we're really impressed. We really were.
Thanks.
In the book, you share a great deal about your life. Can you give our audience a little information about yourself and your journey?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a memoir, but I actually started off in pretty traditional news reporting. I worked at the New York Times for a year and a half reporting for their Metro desk, and then I went to Color Lines and both wrote for the magazine and edited the magazine for 6 years, so sort of traditional news reporting and then independent magazine. And Color Lines is a magazine that's focused on issues of race and politics and culture. And while I was there, I made very concerted efforts to also have coverage of issues around race and sexuality in the LGBT community. So that's a little bit of my background. Along the way, while I was reporting, I was also dipping in to write stories about my family to try to kind of make sense of the community that I had grown up in. And I grew up in just right outside of New York City in New Jersey in a small town called Fairview. My father's from Cuba. My mother's from Colombia. And I grew up with an extended family that included three aunties who had really strong opinions about how I should behave as a young lady. And, of course, that extended to what my sexuality should look like. Very traditional ideas that they were bringing with them from Colombia. And so the book is a coming-of-age story, you know, told in a non-traditional way. It's broken up into three parts. The first part is very much about the women who raised me and ideas about religious traditions, including an Afro-Cuban religion that my father and my mother are practitioner of. And sort of the women that were in our extended community there who tried to kind of help us negotiate through a lot of challenges. And I write very honestly about my dad's alcoholism, my sort of challenges with these aunties, these tias. And the second part of the book is actually how I started the book, which was writing about my sexuality and being bisexual. And coming to bisexuality in college, coming into an awareness of it in college, and writing was actually my way of trying to make sense of my own sexuality, because I wasn't falling into the sort of tidy categories of people around me, either straight or gay. And I read a few books, but writing is just an incredible tool for like understanding like where I'm coming from and what I'm doing. And so that's the second part of the memoir. Which I don't know if I said the title of the memoir is called A Cup of Water Under My Bed. And the third part of the book is dealing with issues of race and class and what it means to grow up in a working class community and then end up working at a place like the New York Times, ending up working, even just working as a writer, period, is really different from the family that I grew up in. So it's sort of, the story is kind of organized that way.
It's done beautifully. Really gives you insight. And I like the way that I really feel like you're actually having new memories when you're writing it, because it does go back and forth and how you connect everything. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I only went through the first part, sorry. But in that, I really like the universality in understanding people's pagan religions and modern religions and how they kind of really intersect and interact.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that Catholicism especially, I always see as like a cultural appropriation of everybody's religions. And, you know, usually they just added more saints. but when it comes to Santeria, that was one of the things the Catholics for a bit afraid of.
Oh, absolutely. And, so and historically, I mean, it's called Santeria in Cuba and in Haiti, Vodun or Voodoo as we know it, and then in Brazil, Candomblé. And,
yeah.
But the religion's also practiced in other areas of Latin America too. But absolutely, it was brought up a lot of fear. I mean, I don't know the history of the other countries. I know more about the history of Cuba, but historically, brought up a lot of fear specifically for the white elite of Cuba, because they clearly saw it as something, it was a way for slaves to organize and also for free blacks to organize originally. And a big part of the reason that the religion survived, despite people being enslaved, is that there were cabildos, these mutual aid societies that were permitted to exist and that were tied to the religion. And of course, as the Catholic Church started to come down on these mutual aid societies, they quickly realized, hey, we can use the Catholic saints as a cover to say we are gathering to venerate this Virgin, for example. And so it was a bit of a mask to help them maintain their religious practices. It's just an incredible, really incredible history. It's so much about, you know, it's a tradition that, it's a religious tradition that also has survived as an oral tradition, right? There isn't a pope somewhere in the Vatican,
right,
somewhere who sort of sends notes and bishops and so forth. Every religious family is its own entity. You apprentice with a godparent for so many years. I mean, it's just incredible. And of course, music is a very, very key part of it. And music has also enabled the religion to continue despite a lot of, you know, public measures that have been taken against the religion historically, both in Cuba and here in the U.S. as well.
There's that little part where Frederick Douglass has his roots to protect, which I thought was a lovely little line.
Well, when I was reading his book for it was actually a literature class that I took as part of my MFA program, and I just did my MFA in creative writing. I did it just 2 years ago. Well, I finished it last year, I guess is what I should say. It was a 2-year program. And so I was reading actually his work as part of a class on black literature. And when I read that, I just, oh my God, I practically jumped out of my seat. I was like, even him, you know, his elders were trying to protect him and to keep him safe, and very much turning to the yerbas. The herbs are such an important, herbs and plants in the natural world is such an important part of the religion. And so even though it wasn't the religion the way it looks like in Cuba, it's fascinating. And I had heard about almost 20 years ago, I had an African-American friend who, when I was telling her about Santeria or Ocha religion, she was telling me, she was listening to me, and she was like, oh, yeah, I know about that from my family down the south. We call them roots. That's what you do, you know. It's amazing to me. Again, just comes back to that theme of, you know, how do we survive, you know, and how do we end up thriving, actually, despite forces that are against us.
Exactly.
Yeah, in my own tradition, we carry stones,
mm-hmm.
Sacred yeah. stones, and mm-hmm. you know they have power in them, and you put power in them, and from where they come from, has a lot of meaning. You know, my dad used to carry all his life, and it was something that I've always wanted to find. That it just kind of got lost when we lost him, but. Was supposed to be a piece of the Blarney Stone, right? Which is mm-hmm. like a typical Irish pagan thing that people won't acknowledge unless they know you really well.
I just wanted to say when you write about your mother taking the splinter out of your dad's hands, just describing your dad's hands. I just felt that whole thing. It was such a public and such a private moment between them. I mean, I could see their faces, you know, being very determined and calm. And, yeah, it was, I just want to tell you, that was really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really important for me to include that scene in the book because I thought, you know, this is such a coming-of-age story and sort of how do we experience intimacy between our parents. And that moment where she's caretaking him and I mean, it's incredibly gendered experience as well. I thought it would be a good mm-hmm. way to share that with readers for them to experience it too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Culture, society, class, economics, religious views, racism, sexism, and abuse meet, intersect, and collide both subtly and violently in this book. It was very compelling to read. It gives everyone a window into our society and its dysfunction as a whole. It was obvious it was written with love for your family. It must have been a hard, painful process revisiting some of the memories. Did this book help you deal with some of those issues?
Absolutely. I would definitely say it helped me. It is definitely not therapy, however, so I always tell people who want to write memoir, you know, get yourself the good kind of tissues, like the kind that come with lotion.
Yeah.
Have those on your desk, because I definitely, you know, cried my way through writing portions of the book, and it's good to have the good tissues that don't, you know, leave you with little nose burns.
Yeah.
But I also did therapy and so many different healing modalities over the years. So so one of the things that now that the book is done and out in the world, it's very interesting because, of course, readers are getting to experience these things for the first time. So so sometimes they're coming to me with a question of, are you okay now? And it's yeah. like, oh, yeah, there's nothing in the book that I'm still processing or trying to work out in any way. It's been, you know, everything that's in the book, I felt comfortable with that being available for the public, you know. And there's many, many stories that are not in the book because I wasn't comfortable with them yet being out. And I might never be, I'm not sure. But writing definitely helped. And it wasn't, you know, it was what I told people, too, is that for me, at least with this memoir, that it was a two-part process. The first part was actually writing a very emotional draft where of some of the stories, not of the whole book, but of some of the stories, simply trying to figure out, to make sense of what happened, simply trying to me trying to figure out, like, what did happen? Why did that happen? You know, and trying, and, you know, it's memoir, so I'm working with memories, some of which can be confirmed, some of which can't be confirmed. Mm-hmm. And so part of, and that emotional draft was where a lot of the Kleenex came out and conversations and therapy. And that was really different from the other draft of the book, which was, now the part where I was working with craft and figuring out, okay, I know what this story, this particular chapter is about, and I know what this means for me. So how do I need to organize the story so that a reader who, for example, doesn't know my father can still have empathy for him? What pieces of information am I missing? And so it was, So at that point, it was about like rearranging elements within the book, highlighting some, moving things around, so that I could take into account like the reader who might, you know, doesn't have like my own personal history.
Yeah, I was really compelled by when your father lost his job and had to go to somewhere else, farther away, and do a different kind of job, and at his age, and it was just, I really felt that. I mean, it was just really. Is how can I explain that? At that, when you get to that point in your life that you have to keep going that way, with like no real reward for anything that you've done all your life, I really felt a lot of empathy for your father. I really did.
Yeah, and it was really important for me to write that particular chapter, which is about the impact of NAFTA on our community, because my father and my mother and my auntie were and are, you know, just three people out of so many. I mean, it was the whole move, you know, it was pretty stark in our neighborhood, as it was, have been in so many, the move from manufacturing to the service sector. And I really wanted to show, the differences and the impacts of like having a union job versus not, sort of the fact that service work is really different, from working with machines, which is what he had worked with his whole life. And so had my mom as a seamstress. So, and so had my auntie as well. So it was really important to write because I didn't feel like I read so many, different kind of pieces about NAFTA and impact. And I just think people, you know, get sort of lost in the sound bites of people's personal stories. And so that's why it was so important for me to tell that story. And because you're right, it happens, you know, at every age. It's impacted very young people, and it's also impacted people in their 60s.
Mm-hmm. Not easy.
No.
Yeah. I mean, NAFTA was in some ways very destructive for lots and lots of peoples and countries. You know, I mean, NAFTA destroyed a lot of our manufacture and garment industry. They went to Mexico, set up shop there for a few years, and as those, you know, as people began to organize in Mexico for, like, livable wages, those jobs went to Asia. And so, you know, there's a continuing impact of, you know, this whole idea of what, you know, free trade, even 20 years later, is still having an effect and impact in the world.
Absolutely. And I love that word free trade. It's one of my favorite phrases. I didn't talk about it in the book, but I feel like I have to talk about that in a future book. I'm like, free trade, a really fancy way to say we want corporations to go after basically slave labor in other countries. It's really incredible.
Well,
I mean, I remember,
you know,
Go ahead, John.
It's really easy to get an illegal immigrant car from Mexico across the border to the United States of America. But when it comes to a human being, then there's a problem, right?
I couldn't hear you because of the audio.
Yeah, you're kind of cutting out really, really bad, John.
Uh-oh.
In and out.
You're breaking up too. But anyway, I was saying that, you know, it's so easy to get product from Mexico to the United States across your border, but when it comes to a person, then there's a big problem with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I mean, we
want what we want. We don't want the people necessarily. I don't know if either of you ever saw the film. I believe the name is Sleep Dealer, but it's this amazing science fiction film where the director writer imagines they have figured out a way for people to stay in Mexico and operate robot machines in the U.S. It's a very powerful film. But when the robots, if a robot is working, for example, on a, you know, 24-story building in Los Angeles or something, and the robot falls to its death or is electrocuted or some way, the person back in Mexico actually suffers the same thing that has happened to the robot. So the person actually runs the risk of dying in the Mexico. It's a really powerful film. I totally encourage you to check it out.
Huh.
Well, I'm going to.
Great. Yeah. I think that we actually do it with robots, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's a guy in the military in some base in the West,
mm-hmm.
you know, flyover region. And he's flying a plane in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen, and he's bombing people with it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've read about some of the impact is that, you know, I mean, these people who have never left the United States in the military have PTSD because of what they did and what they had to do and some of the targets that they didn't hit but killed innocents. And even though they're, you know, a world away, they still have the impact of having done that.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful essay that I just taught in my introduction to creative nonfiction class. It's a braided essay that came out in, I believe, Seneca Review. It's by Catherine Taylor. It's called Inanimate Objects. And she reflects on her brother who flies these drones, basically. But there's all this other language around it. And she looks into sort of the questions of morality around it. It's really, really a fascinating essay.
Yeah.
So you are the co-editor of Colonize This, and I have not read that yet. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It was done back in 2003, is that right?
Yeah, and it came out in 2002. It came out in 2002 or 3, I think. It's an anthology. The book is called Colonize This, A Young Women of Color on Today's Feminism. And my co-editor, Bushra Rahman, and I gathered up, in total, I think it was about 28 women, to write about how they understood feminism, how they felt their feminism, was different because of issues of race, because of issues of immigration. And it was a really beautiful, intense process working on that book. It's not a typical edited collection in the sense that we didn't just, go out and seek pieces and then just send them on to the publisher. We actually worked really intimately with most of the writers. Some of the writers did several drafts of their essays. They really, you know, there were many, many nights of telephone calls back in the day before social media stuff. And it was, so we worked really, really closely with the writers to create these different stories. And our goal was to, we felt, that feminism is generally understood in such a narrow way, and we really wanted to expand the perspectives on feminism that we saw ourselves having and other young women of color at that time and continue to have. And so a lot of times, you know, feminism gets represented as being right now a movement about either, you know, sexual violence or reproductive justice, and sort of it kind of operates in those sort of two arenas, and that's how many people interpret it. And so we wanted these women to share their stories about what feminism had to do with issues of public housing, for example, with issues of gentrification in their neighborhood, what it had to do with having you know, realize that your partner, you'd contracted HIV from your ex-partner, and what that had to do with La Virgen de Guadalupe and being brought up as a Catholic girl from Mexico, whose parents are from Mexico. So we really wanted to, like, look at those intersections of race and class and gender experiences. That was really important for us, and we hoped that it would be a book that would, you know, present it as very personal stories at the same time. It wasn't supposed to be a didactic kind of text in any way. And I'm really happy to say it's been taught, the book has been taught in women's studies classes all over the country and continues to be taught. It's been taught now for more than 10 years, which is just amazing to me. I can't believe it. And I meet a lot of, the biggest compliment that I feel we receive about the book is that people actually, students, and people who find it through other channels will actually say that it was good stories. They read because they really liked the stories, and that they actually, the other common theme that I hear from readers is that it helped them to feel less alone. So you also have, you know, an increasing number of young people of color, and other folks who are entering into higher education in greater numbers than in previous generations. And I think they're very much looking for textbooks that reflect their own experiences or touch on their experiences in some way. And so because of the sort of scope of the book, having contributors everywhere from, you know, Colombia and Pakistan, African-American and Africa, like African immigrants, like really, I think, helped to kind of give it a sense of a big community in between, you know, on the pages. So it's been really, really an amazing, amazing experience with that book.
Well, I can't wait to read it. That sounds great.
I can't believe it's been 12 years since it's come out. I mean, I remember reading it like back in the day.
Yeah. It's crazy.
We look at Colonize This and To Be Real as like kind of the first books to give to a budding feminist. You know, we keep our copies around, and like we've had to buy multiple copies over the years because some young woman or man we've sent a copy off with didn't bring it back after they were done. Which is good. You know, that's just kind of like, you know, you can sometimes find them in the used bookstore. So, you know, it's one of those ones. Oh yeah, we have to pick another copy of that up.
You better just start ordering them by the dozen then.
Yes, I encourage you to order them by the dozens.
Yes, do that.
And I think that's one of the things that I'm really most happy with about the book is that I feel like you can give it to sort of anyone at any stage, you know, like it doesn't have to be part of a women's studies course. Like if you want to read some like good personal essays, like you can also give this book and it'll touch on so many larger issues. So I'm really happy that I feel like it's accessible for just a lot of folks. That makes me really, and also that people have found it, you know, someone found it because she just found it in a bookstore and she was just intrigued and started reading it. And then she's like, it's so good. I'm like reading it, you know, all weekend. So things like that are also just really great compliments.
Yeah, it sounds like it's one of those books that's a resource that one of those books that you can read over and over or come back to and pick out something different each time. So, yeah, that's great.
Well, it's important to have lots of diverse perspectives in the world, right? And people, you know, it's really necessary for people to read about lives that aren't just like theirs. And especially when it comes to understanding and grappling with issues of feminism. I there are these wars in feminism going on right now, and I just see them as like battles that have been taking place and with different names and such forever.
Somebody new.
You know, the economic justice issues that, you know, I read about as a kid, which were in parts of second wave feminism who were doing anti-poverty work and how in those days it was just connected at the hip to feminists, right? Among, you know, parts of the feminist movement and how these things just keep coming back again. And like today the issue is, you know, the lean in versus, you know, 78 cents, which are real, like two very stark different ideas about what feminism means.
Absolutely. I think that, one of the really, really painful parts is that I would say, like, overall feminism has been really, at least at a public level, has been very disconnected with struggles around class and around issues of race, really painfully disconnected.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. John, do you have that there, or do you want me to ask the last question? Do you have your script?
Yeah. I'll tell you, in the 80s, I met my partner, actually, we were doing anti-contra-aid work and Central America solidarity work. Mm-hmm. So that was like, we met all the Cuban-Americans and Colombian and Chilean-Americans in this town because all these groups were associated with the work. And you know, like, I'll also say that the state senator is Salvadoran, his dad, like, was an activist, and he was in the newspaper, and that's why his dad had to come here. For people that don't know, back in the dirty war in El Salvador, names would be printed in the newspaper, and they were the ones who were targeted for death, for the death squads. And so when you got your name in the newspaper, it meant that you really just had to get out.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of look at, you know, I kind of look at that. I also understand, you know, coming from a very diverse community, what it means to be the translator for the family, right? You know, we had a big fight keeping our multilingual aid in our elementary school. It's funny, you know, people on the school board who really didn't understand that when parents had to come to meetings with teachers and administrative staff, that they had to sometimes take a kid out of school in order to translate for them. One of the things that we did in our PTO.
You're gone. You're gone, John. He's talking to me. Yeah, he's gone. He's talking about the translating. I lived a long time in LA, and I saw that quite a bit, and my kids, and a lot of second and third, what they call second and third generation. Some of the difficulties that those children had to face growing up in multiple cultures, and they would talk about how painful it was sometimes to be the interpreter between their parents and something that was going on as a young child, you know, being exposed to some things. You've been gone for a long time, John.
Yeah. Hello.
You've been gone a long time.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Can you hear? Yeah, I can hear you. You can't hear me?
I can hear you now. You were gone a long time.
Oh man, I just had a great question, and it all got. Why don't I call back in?
That's probably a good idea of calling back.
Try to call back in.
Okay. Hold on.
Mm-hmm. But I agree with you, Lynette, that it's is that how you pronounce your name, Lynette?
Yes.
Yeah. It is really difficult for children when they're put in that interpreter role, the role of the child translator. It's definitely can be really challenging because a lot of times it's parentifying children, right? It's putting them in a position where they're having to be grown-ups before they're really ready. And sometimes even when you are grown-up, this is something that's not in the book, but when I was already – this would have been when I was in college. I was probably in college or thereabouts. I was with my mother up at a hospital in Harlem where she received her mammograms at no cost. And part of that was the doctor wanted her to know if she wanted an HIV test. And it was just like, I wasn't a child anymore per se. I was probably 19, but it was just so painfully uncomfortable to ask my mother, do you want an HIV test? And the only person she's ever been with is my dad. And just, it was just, and then, trying to, replay, the doctor, not the doctor, but the nurse could, or the administrator, I think it was, could see the sort of shock on her face of like, this was akin to accusing her of being a loose woman.
Yeah,
the idea that she would even be tested. And then, I, at that point, I did not have all the resources to explain to her, this is not a condemnation of your morality, of your value as a woman. And, just conversations that at that age I wasn't prepared to have that, even now as at the age that I'm at, I'm just in the process of in the next couple of weeks, trying to convince my father who's in his 70s that he needs to have some kind of treatment for his eyes, and he doesn't want to have the treatment. He doesn't know why he has to have it. And, these are folks who grew up in Latin America without any access to medical care. They don't have any history, any kind of relationship with medical care. So the idea that you even go to a doctor to begin with is incredibly, incredibly strange. And the idea that you have to do procedures of any kind or treatments is incredibly strange. So as far as they are comfortable with, it's about taking, we have to take some aspirin because that's helpful. We have to do eye drops because, that's sort of like little things like that are sort of acceptable. But when it sort of requires any kind of prolonged interaction with the medical community, it's very, very challenging for them. So I'm actually really fortunate because at this point they actually live down in Hialeah, which is a community just outside of Miami. And I would say that this Hialeah is kind of, it's more Havana than Havana. It's basically 99.9% Cuban exiles and their children. And so everyone in the town is Cuban, including, the doctors, the neurologists, the mayor, the police force. I mean, just basically everyone, sort of a liability to speak English there. But the benefit to that is that they know the culture. It's not just knowing the language, but they know the culture. So they know why my father is being so resistant, for example, right now with some treatment that he needs. So, that really kind of helps me and my sister and our end right now.
Yeah, I ran into that a lot because I was a nurse in the medical field, and a lot of the things that we had to do at the hospital, it just wasn't something that the older people did, and they were very, very worried and very scared, and the children and grandchildren would have to come in and interpret and explain, and it was difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very difficult.
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better, John.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah, I should have done that earlier. When I hear break up on the other side, I should know it's on my side too. I thought it was interesting, like, that kind of, just talking about, like, the difference between the Cuban American community in New York and the Cuban American community in Miami. I know it's changing in Miami now, but, like, we used to see them as coming from two different planets. Because when I came back from Nicaragua, I stayed at the Quaker, with the Quakers, the AFSC for a bit, and, you know, it was really dangerous for people to do Central America solidarity work in Miami. And there had actually been the bombing of our exhibit and, you know, lots of threats and fire bombings of people's houses and community centers back in those days. And so, you know, it seemed like just a very, you know, very scary place. In New York, on the other hand, there were, you know, there were long-term Cuban Americans who, you know, while they didn't like Fidel Castro, they were interested in normalizing relations with Cuba.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's just like, if you could just talk a little bit about some of that and how much you've seen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. It's worlds of difference. You know, my sister and I joke around about if we had been born and raised in Miami and Hialeah, would we be these like raging Republicans right now? It's so hard to imagine, but I think the answer is we might be. I'm not sure. Because one of the things that I noticed, and I would go as a child, down to Miami during some of the summers, and, you know, we had extended family there, and, you know, the fact that the community in Miami and Hialeah was in a lot of ways so concentrated, right? So you were, you know, it's, you arrived, you're Cuban, and you have family, or you have family of family or friends or cousins, right? And it's just incredibly concentrated. And what's concentrated is not just the people and the experiences that they're coming with, but the stories, you know. So I lived in Miami for 2 years recently, actually, because I wanted to live in a city that was Latino majority. I wanted to see what that experience was going to be like. But one of the things that I discovered as part of that experience is just the way that through all oral tradition, stories are handed down from one generation to the next. So you have this generation that came, you know, after the revolution that has raised a whole other two generations on stories of how they had paradise stolen from them, you know, and the devastation of that for them. And so I have, you know, these extended cousins that, you know, at one point Bill O'Reilly flashed a picture of me on his show. And the reason I knew about it is because my Miami cousins call me and tell me about it because they're watching. they watch Fox, you know, regularly. So that is really different from the kind of Cuban community that I grew up in New Jersey. And actually, my extended family, very right wing, I would say, very conservative. And it wasn't so actually the individual members that I grew up with were not that different from those down in Miami. But for me, coming of age in the community, I was getting access to a lot of other people as well. So there were other, like, my mother's and her family's from Colombia. There were people with those perspectives. There was actually obviously a huge Puerto Rican community in New York City, a Dominican community. And so I knew the world did not revolve around just the one story about what the revolution had meant for Cuba. And I also knew, as I write about in the book, you know, my dad grew up very poor in Cuba, but actually was fighting against Fidel Castro's army. He was part of, he was already in the Cuban military when the revolution happened. And sort of questionable, you know, how much he was actually fighting against Fidel Castro, because there were so many people that were, you know, supportive in so many different ways. But I grew up sort of with a much more complicated picture of Cuba than I think I would have if I had grown up in Miami, just because of the concentration of stories that But I think ultimately stories really shape who we are and what we can imagine as being possible for ourselves.
I just want to tell you that we love your coming out story, and it will help a lot of people.
Thank you.
And any great words of encouragement to other potential bisexual writers?
Yeah, you know, I think that every writer finds what they need. Every writer has a really different journey. For myself, and I'll say this in case it's helpful to someone, having community was really important for me along the way. So early on in my process, I was part of a group in New York City called Women in Literature and Letters. And it was simply a group of three Latina women who had put together an organization. They wanted to just simply be writing with other women who saw writing as political activism and weren't shying away from that. Yeah, and that was really such a pivotal community for me as I came out of college and started writing. It was the reason that I found so many, you know, I discovered James Baldwin through them. I discovered Audre Lorde and sort of all the greats of that generation.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I didn't read those in college. I read them through this wonderful community. And then when I lived in California, I was part of another community there. And it was less formalized, but we were definitely a group who got together. And one of the things that we would do is we would get together for writing dates. And so a lot of times people describe writing as a very lonely process, but that has really not been my experience. And I think part of it is because my friends and I have done these things like getting together at someone's house or in a cafe for a couple of hours together, so getting a little chance to connect with another person, and then putting on our headsets or whatever we need to feel quiet, and doing our writing together, you know, and then at the end, after a couple of hours, sharing that. And we used to do that with a friend, where we would come together in the morning, and then we would write for a couple hours in the morning, break for lunch, and talk about how it was going. And it's just a wonderful way to say, without getting into the details of what you're constructing on the page, just a wonderful way to be like, it's going so well, or it's going miserably, you know. And my friends and I at one point actually figured out how to go away for a weekend so that we could have like a little writing retreat together for a weekend. So things like that have been really important to me, finding writing classes where professors will be really supportive and will know how to lead a class, because a lot of times, you know, not every writer can really teach the process of writing.
Right.
Not every writer can really facilitate a conversation so that you can get the most out of the feedback. So I think that's sort of I learned over the years to really go into a workshop having reflected on what it is that I specifically need from the group. So that way, because with my, you know, I've been in a writing workshop where people have engaged in really intense arguments about child abuse. And it has nothing to do with me or what I wrote. It's not helpful. But that's
right.
What they've needed to do. They've been really moved by what I wrote. But I actually needed help on figuring out X, Y, and Z. So the fact that I go into a workshop and I'm really clear about what kind of help I need has been really, really helpful. And and something that I've been thinking about more recently that I did a little intuitively with the memoir, Cup of Water Under My Bed, is having a book that serves as kind of a role model for yours, you know. It sort of can bring a lot of comfort and a lot of insight to really study one book or a few books, you know, closely, but really having one book that that you're studying for the craft, and sort of when you run into challenges that you can also turn to, well, how did this writer figure that part of their story out?
Right.
How did they do their ending? How did they bring things to a conclusion? Or how did they, you know, handle something really tricky, like writing about their coming out experience? How did they do that in a way that felt really fresh or different, you know, to me as a reader? So those are some of the things that I think have been really important. And in addition to, keep writing, because the the world conspires against us as writers oftentimes between to-do lists and really our own fears. So much of it, I think, is also our own fears of getting to the page and sharing our stories and what will people think, especially when we write anything that can seem to be closely related to our own lives. It can really feel a little bit scarier. So sort of whatever can give you, you know, spiritual sustenance and courage is definitely the way to go. I've always had, actually I haven't talked about this before, but I always kept a little altar right on my desk. And I did that when I went on residencies, when I went away for a couple of weeks to write at a residency. I had like a travel altar that I took with me. And, you know, it was just items that were really, you know, it wasn't from any particular spiritual or religious traditions. They were just items that have been imbued with meaning over the years. A lot of them, were actually sort of toys and candles and a little goddess statue that, a wonderful, healer had given me actually. And so they meant things to me, and I would sometimes light a candle, and that would sort of just bring a really peaceful kind of energy to my workspace and my desk, and sort of like really honoring kind of like that I'm creating space for the next, you know, 20 minutes or a half hour or 3 hours that I'm working. That was also really helpful.
That's a great idea. I recommend that. Mm-hmm. Everybody does that in their own, just in their own mm-hmm. personal lives.
Yeah.
I was going to say that one of the things I feel like as a writer myself is sharing my work with other writers as opposed to just friends and the general audience, that, you know, when you share stuff with friends and general audience type people, they'll say, oh, this is nice, this is fine. But when you share it with another writer, they will pick stuff apart in places that you need it. And, you know, everybody needs a good editor. Mm-hmm, and so it's really, you know, I always find that it's really important when I'm writing to share that with people that aren't going to be nice to me.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it's just like, it's better not to be nice, because if that person really doesn't understand what you're trying to say, then maybe you're not speaking it right, and you have to change so that people that don't know what you know learn it too. And you know, I think that's a big problem for writers in general, is that sometimes we just write for ourselves and the stuff that we know, but like, you know, in order to capture a reader, you have to explain to them what you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Alrighty. Yeah. So let's wrap this up. Is there anything you'd like to add?
You know, the one thing I would love to add is that I'm doing a reading in February at the Writer Center. I'm doing a reading in February at the Writer Center in Bethesda, Maryland. So I would love to, for readers or listeners rather, to who might be in the DC area, to know about that, and I'll send you a link. I just sent it, I think.
Awesome.
For the website.
Great.
He works at Center By. There in DC.
Oh, awesome. Well, we should talk, because maybe I could come. I think I'm reading on a Saturday, so I'll probably be in DC for the whole weekend. If there's something you'd like me to do, I could probably piggyback on that with the reading at the Writer Center.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Oh, definitely. We could do like a brunch or a dinner with you.
Yeah.
And maybe do a Bethesda and make it a, you know, like a double. Right? So that people could see you at the Writer's Center and build up the numbers.
Yeah.
And then,
all right. All links will be provided on the website. Remember, you are not wrong. You're not broken, and you are definitely not alone. You're a human being, and you are bisexual, and your stories matter. Bye.
Bye.
All right.
That's great. Bye. I love that, Lynette, by the way, to the podcast. That is just really awesome.
Oh, good. Yeah. We're small, but we're an impact, so.
Hi, I'm Nucha, the host of Nutty Bites.
And hi, I'm Tech, Nutty's regular guest.
Or antagonist. Our podcast is like a call-in show where geeks get to debate topics about speculative fiction.
We don't really debate.
Sure we do. We debate topics such as lame superpowers, the best villains, and our favorite apocalypses.
We're more of like rant, rave, and then have massive nerd rages.
People call in from all over the world, sometimes minor celebrities, and we've even had some supervillains show up.
Do you ever notice that you never have any superheroes or good guys?
I'm a good guy.
Compared to what?
Antagonist. Not really a guest. Nutty Bites, NIMWAF.org.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Bi-Net USA or the Bicast crew.
Yeah, and don't you get like 20% off Big Macs if you're a manager?
You know, back in the day when I was there, you actually, during the shift, you actually got any kind of meal that you wanted at no cost. You know, it's a franchise business, though, so that might have just been true about the one store where I worked at. And then people stole food all the time.
Yeah, I worked a lot of fast food places.
You stole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then I managed, so I had to do a lot of taste testing. So it was like, yeah.
taste testing. That's what it's called.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Bi-Net USA or the Bicast crew.
Look at that.